This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. College basketball, the season is starting to heat up. You got conference play underway, and before you know it, those overeager colleagues at work are going to be pestering you to fill out that March Madness bracket. So this week, we're opening up with a story set in the world of college basketball, and specifically, Davidson College. Now, if you know anything about the men's basketball program at this small liberal arts school in North Carolina, it's that Davidson, the Davidson Wildcats, they produced a two-time MVP of the NBA named Stephen Curry. But this story goes far beyond Steph. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
The first time he saw Steph Curry play basketball in 2006, Tim Chartier didn't know much about the freshman guard.
I don't think I knew his name yet. I did know that he was a very good math student.
That's because Tim, or Dr. Chartier, as he's known on the Davidson campus, is a math and computer science professor. And earlier that fall, Dr. Chartier says the professors in his department had discussed promising students taking Calculus 1.
We do talk about, is there anyone that we should be encouraging to be a math major? And this young basketball player came up. And so the first time I ever saw Steph Curry, I turned to my wife and I pointed and I said, that's the kid who's doing really well in Calc 1. I don't necessarily identify him that way now.
Steph Curry famously led Davidson to the Elite Eight of the 2008 NCAA tournament. But more recently behind the scenes, Dr. Chartier and a group of math-minded students have also aided the Davidson basketball program. Dr. Chartier now oversees a student group called CAT Stats, which uses advanced analytics to help the basketball team.
The manpower we have is extensive from what our students are willing to invest in terms of their time and their efforts.
That's Davidson men's basketball associate head coach Matt McKillop.
So when I walk into my office on a Monday and we've got a game that following Saturday, I'm looking at a piece of paper that they've crafted that basically tells me everything I need to be aware of as I begin all the work I'm going to put into watching film and scouting an opponent. So the time that they save us is extraordinary.
And helping coaches scout opponents is just a small part of what CAT Stats now does to help the Davidson team. But getting to this point, forging this alliance between the college's math experts and its athletes, wasn't so easy. It required a math professor who is perhaps a little unconventional. Seth Kindig started at Davidson in 2010. As a sophomore, he took Dr. Chartier's linear algebra class. Early in the semester, one of Seth's friends pointed something out about the professor.
Have you ever noticed that he uses his hands to teach a lot? Come to find out later, Dr. Chartier is actually a mime in his free time.
Ford Higgins also started at Davidson in 2010 and came to know Dr. Chartier.
Another thing was, I don't know if he still does, but he at least used to keep a 12-pack of Diet Coke in his office, and man, he would crush those things.
But more important to this story than the miming or the Diet Coke was that since 2009, Dr. Chartier had been using math to predict the outcomes of the NCAA tournament. As a homework assignment, he'd even had students build their own models to fill out their brackets. And for the summer of 2013, Dr. Chartier asked student Seth Kindig to stick around to work as a research assistant on a basketball-related study.
We built a model that actually tried to group NCAA basketball teams based on style, and we used a mathematical method called cosine similarity. And we figured that if we...
Okay, don't worry about cosine similarity. All you need to know is that they were trying to use math to figure out which college teams played a similar style of basketball. And Seth and Dr. Chartier wanted to see if the results they were getting made any sense. So you send an email to the assistant coaches.
Yeah.
I guess, what were you expecting? I mean, who knows if they would even respond to you, I guess.
One of the nice things about Davidson is we're a school of 2,000 students. So when I send an email to the assistant coaches, I'm sending an email to someone that I know and that I see. And so I will get a response. That doesn't guarantee interest.
I was interested in it, but I didn't think too much of it, you know.
That's Davidson associate head coach Matt McKillop again.
I felt like this was something that I was almost doing him a favor.
At the time, Matt and the rest of the Davidson staff were like most college basketball coaches. They only looked at traditional stats, points, rebounds, turnovers, and they didn't really know how advanced analytics could be applied to basketball. Then Seth and Dr. Chartier showed Matt and another assistant their results.
And they said, oh, this makes a lot of sense. And then they said, you use mathematics for this? And we said, yes.
It was eye-opening in a number of ways.
The coaches started asking their own questions.
Could you answer this for us or this for us?
Around that same time, Coach Matt McKillop learned that two of the basketball team's student managers, Miles Abbott and Ford Higgins, who you heard from earlier, were also math majors interested in advanced analytics. When the school year began, Dr. Chartier got a visit from Seth, Miles, and Ford. They asked if they could work together to help the men's basketball team.
And so I said, from a professor point of view, I have three students asking if they can do more math with me. So I was like, of course.
But Dr. Chartier also cautioned the group. The Davidson basketball program was successful. It's not like the team needed to make any radical changes. Even after losing Steph Curry, who, by the way, did voluntarily take Calc 2, according to Dr. Chartier, but ended up majoring in sociology, the Wildcats had been back to the NCAA tournament twice.
And so I also was very honest. Yes, we can try, but to be quite frank, I don't know if we'll actually create something that they can actually use. If you're okay with that, I'm all in. And they said, yes, we want to try.
So the group that would come to be known as Cat Stats was born. Ford, Miles, and Seth started crunching numbers. But they and Coach Matt McKillop also needed to get Davidson's longtime head coach on board.
So he has a pretty old-school approach. He was not as quick to be interested in seeing these numbers.
So Matt proceeded with finesse.
We would give him a little bit and a little bit more, and then hopefully we'd have some film to back up some of these numbers with.
And I guess he probably trusts you.
He may not always make it appear that way, but I think so. Deep down, I think so.
See, Matt McKillop has a pretty strong connection with the Davidson head coach. It's his father, Bob McKillop.
He's the kind of guy that will be like, I don't even want to think about analytics, but then he'll plan a practice and it'll be designed to emphasize certain things that we talked about.
The three original Cat Stats members faced their own challenges. Seth studied lineup efficiency, essentially looking at how different combinations of Davidson players fared on the court together. That meant Seth would have to track which combination of players was on the court at all times and record the results of every single possession, made basket, missed basket, or turnover.
So I was in my dorm room late at night most of the time. I would watch film of the game with the Excel spreadsheet open, just basically hunched over the keyboard, you know, like typing in numbers as fast as I could.
Seth says at first it took him 4 hours to get through a single game. Meanwhile, Ford wrote up his first scouting report for one of Davidson's upcoming opponents. The coaches wanted something that would be easy to read, you know, bullet points. That's not what Ford turned in.
It was pretty much just a wall of text. It was not good.
But Ford quickly got the format down. And instead of needing 4 hours to get through the film of each game, Seth cut the process to an hour. And Matt says his dad began to trust the analytics more and more.
Once he saw that we were making the right decisions, I think he was pretty bought in to the extent that he possibly could.
About a third of the way through that 2013-14 season, the coaches brought Seth and Dr. Chartier to a game in upstate New York. They were in the locker room before tip-off,
where the coaches go over the last points of this is what we need to be thinking when we play the game. And Seth suddenly turns to me and says, good grief, this is all my work.
So it was going well. But soon two things started to dawn on Dr. Chartier.
First of all, I was very aware that the coaching staff depended on the work that we did. That created a lot of concern, mainly because all the members of the group were seniors.
And you don't even have a recruiting budget or scholarships to offer.
No. Yeah, there's no Cat Stats draft.
But that next year, five new students joined Cat Stats, and the group once again supported the men's basketball team. From there, the club took off. In the third year, there were 13 members, and they started working with the women's basketball team, too. The fourth year, there were 30 students. This year, there are more than 80 Cat Stats members.
At this point, we support men and women's basketball, men and women's soccer, volleyball, football, baseball, swimming, and we started some field hockey work this year as well.
And Cat Stats has now become part of the recruiting pitch to prospective Davidson athletes. When Matt McKillop is bringing high school prospects to campus, he doesn't just show them the training facilities and the basketball gym. He'll introduce them to Dr. Chartier.
It's unique that we can recruit a player and say, hey, here's a New York Times article about one of our professors, what he does with analytics.
Are other coaches, if they find out about this, have they expressed jealousy to you about your analytics help here?
I haven't really seen much jealousy or had too many conversations with coaches about it. Everybody's fairly secretive. You know, I have a Cat Stats shirt, but I don't walk around in it when I'm recruiting or around other college coaches. I don't want to draw too much attention to one of the benefits that we have.
Well, I have to say, doing national public radio interviews might not help so much with the secrecy, but hopefully they don't listen to NPR.
I don't know that. I don't know how many college coaches are listening to NPR. I'm lucky. I have a wife who will forward me a few things that I need to listen to, but I hope this is a little bit of a safe space.
Except there's already at least one basketball coach out there who has the inside scoop on the analytics help the Davidson men's basketball program is getting. Seth Kindig, one of the founding members of Cat Stats, now teaches at a high school in Georgia.
I have taught every high school math. This year, I'm teaching AP Calculus for the first time. And kind of most important to me is that I also am the varsity girls basketball coach.
I probably don't have to tell you that Seth keeps track of his team's lineup efficiencies.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Hey, football fans, it's that time of year again.
Eternal story. Tom Brady in Super Bowl.
No! The Pats flamed out!
Yeah, it's almost time for Super Bowl haiku. You know what to do. Write some funny, clever, absurd haikus. You break them into lines of 5, 7, then 5 syllables. You know how haiku works. Come on. Then submit them by emailing us at oag@wbur.org. Or post them to our Facebook page, that's at Only a Game NPR, or go to our website, onlyagame.org. Super Bowl Haiku 26. A lot's on the line. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Do eat this, don't eat that. If you feel like it's time to finally end your war with food, this is the podcast for you. Food, we need to talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jason Gay, and it's time for 3 stories you should know.
I have made the decision to dismiss AJ Hinch and Jeff Luhnow.
All right, baseball went nuts this past week. Major League Baseball released the results of an investigation which concluded that the Houston Astros electronically stole signs during their championship 2017 season and then used loud thwacks on a garbage can. I'm not making this up. Loud thwacks on a garbage can to alert their teammates what pitch was coming. That led to the Astros firing their manager and their general manager. And that is just the beginning. To discuss that and more, I'm joined by Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Welcome back, Amira Rose.
Thanks for having me.
And joined by the Ringers, Brian Curtis. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, Jason.
All right, friends. I'm going to kick it off here because baseball, as we know it, it's burning. This off-season Astros story has kicked off some of the most aggressive recriminations I've ever seen in sports. You got AJ Hinch, the manager. He's out. Jeff Luhnow, general manager. He's out. The former Astros bench coach turned World Series Red Sox manager Alex Cora is out. Now, the former Astros player turned yet-to-manage-one-game Mets manager Carlos Beltran, he's out. He didn't even get to manage the Mets. This is all because a bunch of donkeys down in Houston decided that it would be a smart idea to bang on a trash can and signal what pitch was coming. And, of course, went on to win a World Series in the very same year. Now, it's really become one of the most bizarre and hilarious scandal tracks in baseball history, and baseball has not had a shortage of scandals, but should it not distract from what is the main takeaway here in my book? The Los Angeles Dodgers kind of have a beef. They would like to be awarded the 2017 World Series. Amira Rose, I'll start with you. You know, baseball, as I said, has been through this kind of thing before, scandals before. Can it dig itself back from this one?
Yeah, I mean, actually, scandals make baseball more popular. I mean, this is not the happy, you know, oh, cheating's terrible take. Like, it is. Okay, that's terrible. But baseball has been talked about more this week in offseason than I've seen in a really long time. I think all eyes are on baseball in a time that usually we're still having headlines being dominated by football. You know, we're in an Olympic year, but somehow baseball has carved itself a nice little pocket of discussion on the talk show. So actually, I think they are going to dig themselves out of it quite fine.
But Brian, I mean, the nature of this scandal, I mean, okay, steroids, what did they lead to? They led to people hitting 50, 60, 70 home runs. That was an exciting thing. It made the game more, you know, enlivened. This is quite a bit different. Does the nature of it make it a bigger problem for the sport?
I don't think so, because I think people may understand cheating of this kind differently, or they may have a better idea about it than, you know, pharmacological cheating. I think what scared people about PEDs is it just seems so strange and foreign. Here, you know, you're making noises with a trash can. You know, that just seems, yeah, I know you compared this in your Wall Street Journal column to a Coen Brothers movie, but I think you went way too highbrow there. It's more Eastbound and Down, Naked Gun level cheating scheme.
Amira Rose, you're up next here with some news from the WNBA.
Yeah, so the WNBA finally announced that they had come to agreement, a new collective bargaining agreement in place. It's 8 years, and let me tell you, I think it's a gem. It pushes the earning potential for an individual player up to as much as $500,000, almost triple of what somebody could earn currently. Revenue sharing, which has been a big point. The NBA players take 50-50 revenue sharing. WNBA, up until this point, has been at 20%. Now they have a plan in place that allows for them to earn up to 50% if the league continues to grow and sponsorships are there. And also, lastly, included stuff which I like to call things they should have clearly already had. Traveling, they now will have individual rooms. And they don't have charter flights, but they will be mandatorily upgraded to Economy Plus. And they also have, I mean, some of this is like, exactly. But maternity benefits are huge. They get a full salary if they have maternity things and a child care stipend. That's a really big deal. And there's a domestic violence policy now on the books, which was missing. So what caught your eye the most about the CBA? Do you have lingering questions? And can this be a model for women's domestic leagues moving forward?
Well, the first thing that came to mind on that score was that WNBA players did not have individual hotel rooms on the road before this new CBA.
Yeah.
The biggest stars in basketball had lesser accommodations than sports writers. Like, think about that. How insane is that?
You mean you're not two for a room at the Ringer?
No, we don't. We don't split the Super 8. We get our own Super 8 rooms at the Ringer. But you know, I think the media coverage thing is still going to be a challenge. I think this is another thing, a little bit like baseball, where just the coverage of the CBA gets everybody's eyes on the WNBA in a way maybe they wouldn't be at this time of year. It's just going to be, again, coaxing these now, you know, sort of withering media companies to really cover it and to cover it like a real league, as opposed to having part-timers and stringers handle it as they have in many times in the past.
All right, Brian, we're going to go to you, and I think you're coming to us from the pristine world of college athletics.
Well, when we talk about college athletics and the question of money, of amateurism, we usually do it in this very theoretical way. We don't do it in the way of a former college football star standing on the field passing out currency after a game. But that is what Cleveland Browns wide receiver Odell Beckham Jr. did on Monday night after his alma mater LSU won the national championship. He was standing on the field. He had a lot of money in his hand. He pressed some money into the hands, according to a video, of wide receiver Justin Jefferson, a junior who has fortuitously, given all the NCAA rules, declared for the draft. Now, this got people's hackles up. We began talking about penalties and what are we going to do about this? And is Odell Beckham Jr. some kind of booster? Does that make it worse that he played for LSU or something like that? Amateurism, all that stuff. But I couldn't help but think if people who are critics of the current system of amateurism have been trying to embarrass the NCAA in various ways over the last many years and many decades, is there any better way than just standing on the field after the national championship and passing out money? Is there any better way to highlight the problems with the system?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, the hypocrisy is bare to everybody who sees. I don't even know. I've lost count of the money made by coaches and their precious little postseason bonuses. But I think what is complicated, of course, is the arrest warrant that's then issued for the, I don't even know how to describe the post-locker room cop interaction.
Fanny slap. I think he slapped the fanny of a police officer.
I cuss too much. That's a better way of saying it. And I think that what you see is some of that has really given some cover to the NCAA because all these reemerging narratives about Odell Beckham Jr. and how he was making a fool of himself in the locker room and on the field.
Yeah, I agree that the NCAA has to be kind of thrilled in a way that this is the thing that they're kicking around this week rather than something much more severe happening at Penn State where you had a federal lawsuit filed from a former Penn State college football player alleging, you know, serious hazing within the college football team. And that's the kind of thing that the NCAA doesn't want anything to do with. They'd much rather talk about Odell Beckham than anything like that. Amir Rose, you're at Penn State. I just curious, you know, with this lawsuit that came out earlier in the week, what's the mood on campus about this?
It's certainly news around here. The student paper, it's the front page, and it's certainly not a position the institution would like to be in. But I think it's looking at some hard conversations and continued reckonings that they've been dealing with, not just with the football program and obviously the Sandusky case, but with hazing cases that have happened, especially the case of Timothy Piazza, which resulted in death on campus a few years ago.
Brian, do you anticipate this story kicking up back again? I mean, it seems so glib to talk about like there just being such a clutter of media stories and sports, but there's just so much stuff happening. Do you anticipate that this kind of comes back around at some point?
You know, probably it's, and I say that as somebody who thinks it's an important story and it should get more coverage. But it's also one of those things where I think, you know, we have trouble as a sports media sort of focusing on things and we have trouble prioritizing things. And you see something like this that maybe doesn't fit into the constructs of, oh, here's a crazy thing that happened on Twitter, or here's, you know, an off-season signing, or here's an NBA player tweeting about another NBA player. It doesn't fit into those groups, and so it's harder to do. And it maybe, unfortunately, gets kicked off the front page and kicked off of Twitter a little bit. Again, I say that as somebody who would rather it be front and center and rather us having a conversation about these things.
Well, I imagine we'll be talking about this at some point down the road on this exact segment. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and The Ringer's Brian Curtis. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Jason.
The name of this program, you know, it's called Only a Game, but you know what that means. It means we cover sports, right? Field sports, basket sports, balls, all that stuff. But not always. And about a year ago, Only a Game's Gary Wallach had a story about, well, different kinds of games, and a guy who's collected and shared a lot of them.
When Gary Vincent was a kid, he and his family spent their summers in Laconia, New Hampshire. There, on the shores of Lake Winnipesaukee, visitors camp, hike, and swim. But Vincent was often found at a 70,000-square-foot indoor entertainment center called Fun Spot. He liked to play the arcade games he couldn't find back home in Connecticut.
Crazy climber and alpine ski. Alpine ski never really caught on with a lot of people, but I got pretty good at it.
In the summer of 1981, Vincent had just graduated high school. He took a fill-in job as a floor attendant at Fun Spot. He helped customers whose tokens jammed in pinball machines. He handed out prizes at the counter near the row of skee-ball games. The job was supposed to last 3 weeks.
And 37 years later, I'm still here.
After a brief stint in college, Vincent took a managerial job at FunSpot. He didn't enjoy that very much, but business boomed. It was the golden age of the arcade, when customers put their tokens down and waited in long lines for a shot at games like Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, and Frogger. But it didn't last.
83, 84 is the era when the crash occurred.
Affordable home entertainment systems like Intellivision and Atari offered arcade-quality graphics and gameplay. The big, bulky stand-up consoles were no longer in demand. People stopped showing up.
Anywhere from 75 to 80 to 90% of arcades closed in a very short period of time.
Thousands of Zaxxon, Galaga, Asteroids, and other console games ended up in dumps. But FunSpot survived. It had a bowling alley, kids' rides, and lots of other attractions. It had ample space to store its big console games, and Vincent had learned how to repair and maintain them. Then in the early 90s, Vincent noticed something funny happening when visitors showed up.
They would see a Defender on the floor or a Pac-Man and say, "Wow, they used to have one of these at the pizza place in town, but they took it out, so I'm so happy you have a few of these games left."
That got visitors asking about other games they remembered. Vincent saw an opportunity.
September of 98 was when I approached the owners at FunSpot and said, "I want to start a museum."
They said yes. The IRS granted nonprofit status, and the American Classic Arcade Museum was born. Gary Vincent was the curator. At first, he had his doubts.
Where are we going to go with this? Is anyone going to like it? Will there be any interest?
Undeterred, Vincent got to work. The classic games FunSpot already owned were scattered throughout the massive building, so he shepherded them into their own dedicated 7,000-square-foot room. Then he worked on the atmosphere.
The room is darker than any of the other rooms that are in the building.
And louder. Vincent installed speakers in the ceiling that pump in 70s and 80s music. But Vincent wanted new, or rather old, games to add to the existing collection. He visited trade shows and networked with game enthusiasts. Sometimes the games found him.
Some person will come in and say, "Hey, cleaning out the garage. My wife says throw them out." I said, "Well, don't throw them out. I'll take them."
He found games at yard sales and on eBay. They were in various stages of working order, so Vincent bought old control panels, marquees, and industry-standard 19-inch screens. While juggling his other responsibilities at FunSpot, he found time to hole up in his massive workshop to repair and reconstruct games.
And I'll sit on a cabinet for 10, 15 years trying to find the rest of the pieces to put it back together. And that is always very exciting to me. I don't know why. Most people probably think I'm nuts, but that is what I enjoy.
ACAM now features over 250 classics from the golden age of the arcade game. It's the largest collection in the world, and visitors can play them all. But there was one game in particular that Vincent had his eye on.
I had always wanted a Death Race, and they were hard to find because in 1976, when the game came out, it was very controversial.
In Death Race, the player tries to drive a primitive-looking black-and-white car over pedestrians who scream when they die.
By today's standards, it would be, it's just a game where you run over these stick figures. But back then, it was, it's violent. So a lot of them were pulled from arcades and destroyed.
Very few Death Race consoles survived. But one day, Vincent saw one listed on eBay. It was the only one he'd ever seen, with yellow and black graphics on the cabinet. So he bought it. He was thrilled. Weeks later, the game arrived.
All wrapped in plastic, and we're cutting all the plastic away. And then you'd get that whiff. Mold, mildew, damp, dirt floor, cellar smell. And it just became more overpowering as we cut more of the plastic off. And the smell was horrible.
The fiberboard used on most arcade game cabinets is porous. It picks up odors if stored in areas with moisture.
And animals, big problem. A video game is basically a gigantic mouse condominium. So now I'm starting to think that I have this $1,500 boat anchor, and I moved the whole mess up into the shop, wrapped it in a tarp, and it sat there for a year and a half. And then one day, I had some time, and I said, you know what? It's now or never.
Vincent decided to rebuild the cabinet from scratch.
I posted on one of the game forums what I was doing. So one guy in Florida says, well, I can scan the artwork for you. In the meantime, another gentleman out in Oregon said, I do silk screening. I can make the screens. So he flew in and spent a day in my shop with me putting silk screened artwork back on that game.
Vincent placed the fully restored Death Race on the ACAM floor. I've played it, and it doesn't smell anymore. It's one of the museum's many gems, including a 1973 version of Pong. And Computer Space, the first commercially available video game, released all the way back in 1970. These days, ACAM is an educational resource for enthusiasts of all sorts, including game club members and students from New England colleges. On my first visit to ACAM, I watched as 200 game design majors from Champlain College arrived on a field trip. They stormed ACAM's aisles like a swarm of aliens from Space Invaders.
And I always enjoy watching that because they've grown up in an era with amazing graphics, sound. Put on the headphones, you're in another world, where these games are so old. They are playing games that were made before they were born. Always brings a big smile to my face when you see parents teaching their kids how to play the games they played when they were younger. You know, oh, here, let me show you, because I was really good at this.
On that first visit to ACAM, I was there with my wife and our son, Daniel. He's one of those game design majors from Champlain College. We located some of the games my wife and I played together in our college student union. Dig Dug, Centipede, Millipede, and Q-Bert. My son watched over my shoulder as I guided the cute fuzzy orange Q-Bert away from the bouncing purple snake with the nasty-looking fangs. And I realized something. Daniel is exactly the same age I was when I began playing these games with his mom. I cleared level 3 and leaned in closer to the screen. I couldn't see too well. There was something in my eye.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. We'll be right back with the one and only Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
It seems like you really like podcasts, but have you ever thought about making one?
Okay, so we have a guide for you, especially if you're a kid in school and want to make a podcast of your own. Check out the new podcast from NPR's Student Podcast Challenge.
Listen and share with your friends.
I'm Jason Gay, and next week on Only a Game, Anna Horford wants you to know that if you talk smack about her basketball-playing brother Al, you're going to have to answer to her. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Jason.
So, Monday's college football championship game, LSU defeats Clemson 42-25. Head coach Ed Orgeron, he calls this team 15-0, a team for the ages. Is Coach O right?
I think it is. I think it's one of the best teams I've ever seen. The amount of speed at every position on that team was really startling. And of course, you know, Joe Burrow is a great story. He goes from being an extra piece at Ohio State to being this incredible, you know, Heisman Trophy winning first round draft pick, sorry, you're going to Cincinnati kid. And that's just a terrific story.
One of the more celebrated behind the scenes brainiacs from this LSU team is already out the door. Joe Brady, who's LSU's like 30-something assistant whiz kid, the guy who did all the coaching receiver stuff and kind of gets credit for all the Joe Burrow mania. He's gone off to the Carolina Panthers, which of course have a new head coach in Matt Rhule. So we know how this hot coach thing goes in sports. Are we looking at Joe Brady, 31-year-old Jets head coach next season?
I mean, who can say? I mean, obviously, people are judging this based on the success that the guy at the LA Rams has had. You know, but as you said, Brady is considered now the hot offensive genius du jour. And mm-hmm. now he's going to have to go to Carolina and deal with the whole Cam Newton question, which will be very interesting.
Meanwhile, speaking of the Carolina Panthers again, Luke Kuechly is retired from football. This is one of the great linebackers in the sport. He's out at age 28. That's a big loss for the Panthers, but he's not alone in this kind of move. It seems like more players concerned about health and, frankly, some players who've earned a fair amount of income are taking a voluntary early retirement. Are we going to see more of this in the NFL, you think, Charlie?
I sort of hope so. I mean, if you think you have a problem, you do. And I think Luke Kuechly is doing a very smart thing. The fact that he's already made his money is completely irrelevant. This is a guy who wants to be able to move and think when he's 50. And I don't think anybody can argue with him about that. But you wonder how many players at the taxi squad level or high college level are just in the secrecy of their own thoughts thinking, that's it. My chance at being on somebody's special teams isn't worth cracking my head every day in practice.
All right, over in hockey, the Las Vegas Golden Knights, they fired Gerard Gallant. That's right. The Golden Knights have fired the most famous coach in their history. I mean, granted, it's only 2.5 years of history, but I don't know. They've shown him the door. Peter DeBoer's in. Team isn't even that bad. They've lost 4 games in a row, but these guys are still in playoff contention. Was this a rash gamble, Charlie, by the Golden Knights?
It's a tremendous rash gamble. This guy got them to the Stanley Cup Finals in their first year. That should get you at least 5 more years on the job. And as you pointed out, the Knights aren't that bad. I mean, it's entirely possible that ownership got spoiled by that first season. But it usually takes ownership of a professional sports team, you know, a lot longer than this to act like idiots. I mean, I don't get this one at all.
I don't know if you heard about this, but there was this little tempest about sign stealing in Major League Baseball this week. You know, sort of blew up. And one former major leaguer is expressing his outrage with words of fire. And who might that be, Charlie?
That's Pete Rose. He's very upset that the Astros were cheating. I wonder how much money they cost him. But I'll tell you, it's been a remarkable week for Pete Rose, because not only is there a scandal that's bigger than his in baseball now, but the guy who investigated and got him like permanently bumped from baseball immortality, John Dowd, is all caught up in this whole Ukraine scandal.
That's right. I mean, is there any chance of this scandal with the Astros perhaps moving the pendulum the other way for Rose's candidacy for the Hall of Fame, or is that just a no-fly?
I think there are too many people calcified in their opinions. Although it is good, I'm telling you, it's going to make some voters down the line who are voting on Jose Altuve, for example, it's going to make them wonder. And it's spreading, too.
And finally, Charlie, Joe Burrow, the LSU guy, he hasn't even been drafted yet by the Cincinnati Bengals. They're presumed to take him number one. And he's already kind of making some fuss with the local residents. In a tweet from 2018 that has been archived and shown all around this week, Burrow trashed the city's famous Skyline Chili. What is Skyline Chili, Charlie? And did Joe Burrow actually tell the truth?
Yeah, it's basically foul-tasting meat soup. It's a trademark of the city, but as people know, this is the city that allegedly outsourced all its sin to Northern Kentucky. So I don't know how far on the edge that Cincinnati's ever been. I mean, at least since the departure of Dr. Johnny Fever. But good for Joe Burrow, because he plainly speaks truth to power.
Charlie Pierce is off the board for the Cincinnati Bengals draft. He is also the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
So this is a fun story. You know, we're amid this era in which participation in high school sports, it's going down. And you can blame concerns about concussions or helicopter parents, and you can blame those video games. We love to blame video games. But the numbers don't lie. They're stark. Across the board, participation in high school sports is down, region to region, across the United States, except in a few specific instances. And my colleague, Rachel Bachman at the Wall Street Journal, has found one. Girls wrestling. That's right. At a time when participation in high school boys wrestling is flat, going down, girls wrestling is booming. It grew by close to 30% last year alone. Half the states in the country are going to have a girls wrestling tournament this year. So I asked Rachel to come on with us at Only a Game to tell us about this delightfully surprising story. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Jason.
First of all, how did you learn about this? Who's your deep wrestling contact here?
Well, I've always loved to track trends in sports, and especially high school sports, because, you know, that's when most Americans get exposed to them and really get involved. And,
yeah. And
I saw the numbers of girls wrestling, and I about had to rub my eyes because they're just so counter to all the other trends.
So there have always been young women who've come out for high school wrestling. However, they've been told, all right, you got to be on the boys' team. And that's not the most hospitable environment, right?
It's not. It's downright awkward. And, of course, we're talking about teenagers, right, who are squaring off against each other at the most awkward time of their lives. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's been less than ideal.
And there have been controversies. I mean, there have been situations, right, where you've had girls wrestlers who have competed with boys and then boys who are so unwilling to wrestle them that they forfeit matches.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, you know, just last winter in Colorado, the state tournament, a boy refused to wrestle two girls he was on track to wrestle against, and he cited sort of personal and religious reasons for doing that. And those girls end up finishing fourth and fifth in the state in the boys' state tournament. Mm. So that shows, one, the lingering stigma of wrestling against girls for some boys, and also that there are girls who still stick in there and wrestle against boys.
Sure, of course. So what we're talking about here is this momentum with girl-specific teams. And where is this coming out of? There's a state or a region of the country that has really embraced this and pushed on it?
There have been some groups like Wrestle Like a Girl, a nonprofit that's really pushed this, and USA okay. Wrestling that really recently has advocated for schools to add teams and for states to add state tournaments. But Texas and Hawaii were really the pioneers. They had girls' state tournaments in the late 90s. Hmm. And that was even before women's wrestling was added to the Olympics, which was in 2004. As you mentioned, high school sports in general are really stagnating.
Yeah.
So any potential area of growth, schools have to look at. And also, you know, boys' wrestling, for various reasons, has sort of ebbed and flowed. And adding a girls' team can really bolster the boys' program.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying that when you have this healthy girls' team, it actually creates a situation where more boys are going out for the boys' team?
Yeah, I mean, everyone wants to be sort of in the place to be, right?
Yeah.
And so the more athletes on a team, like, the more exciting it is for everybody.
Now, you note in the story that it's taken quite a while for schools to figure this out, but this is not a case of Title IX happening and everyone just throwing together a girls' wrestling team. We are more than a generation removed from that. What was the delay all about here?
That's a great question. It really was this chicken and egg situation where girls' teams didn't exist because not enough girls came out to justify them. And then girls weren't comfortable coming out for high school wrestling because there weren't separate girls' teams. And it really did take some advocacy groups and USA Wrestling to say, hey, we've got to stop this cycle and really create some places for girls to go.
There are a couple references in the story to kind of
yeah.
old male, you know, attitudes about this.
Yeah.
The idea like, we can't let girls wrestle. What are you talking about? Did you encounter much of that when
right.
you were doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very old, relatively conservative sport. For instance, there was a longtime volunteer and wrestling dad in Indiana who said his daughter wanted to wrestle, and he really balked at that. He mm-hmm. saw wrestlers as hard-nosed and gritty and not the things he saw in his daughter. But after she started, you know, he acquiesced and he saw her confidence go up and, you know, her will to succeed, and she became more decisive and she got good at it. And he just did a 180.
He just saw all these benefits.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, it was still wrestling. I think that was the other thing. It sort of demystified that, you know, he thought maybe this is going to be a totally foreign form of the sport. It's still wrestling, you know?
Well, boundaries are dropping across combat sports, it seems. You know, we see with mixed martial arts and certainly in women's boxing, there are getting to be big names, sometimes household names from those sports. And these were sports that, you know, less than a decade ago said we'd never ever do this in a million years.
Yeah, things have changed really quickly. And of course, you know, with the speed of the internet and social media, there's a whole generation of girls who are seeing that. And these things are just normal for them now.
And I imagine there's no substitute for actually seeing it in action. And I'm sure you got the opportunity to watch some high school girls wrestling. And what is the atmosphere like?
I mean, it's very similar. You know, a lot of the times the meets coexist, like state tournaments, things like that are held in the same place. So there's a lot of the same kinds of energy. And remember, you know, moms and dads, they have girls and boys, of course. And so a lot of them have one kid on one team and one kid on another. And so because it is such a tight-knit sport, there really is less and less this sort of harsh division between the girls and boys.
I have a son and a daughter, and they can both out-wrestle me now. And they're both under 10, sadly, for me. What happens to women wrestlers who are competing after high school when they want to go on and compete at the next level in collegiate wrestling? As far as I can tell, it's not a sanctioned NCAA sport as men's wrestling is.
That's right. It's not an official sport that the NCAA holds a championship for. But that is starting to change. A committee at the NCAA actually voted to make it an emerging sport, which essentially means it's up next to become official. And of course, there are many, many women in college. In fact, in many places, there's more women than men. And so many colleges want more sports that women can participate in. So they're welcoming, you know, new sports, certainly with open arms.
Rachel, it wasn't that long ago that the Olympics were considering getting rid of wrestling, which was sort of unimaginable considering it was one of the original Olympic sports, but it's back now. Is it safe?
Yeah, I think it is safe. And it was really shocking when it was cut from the Olympics.
Right.
And it never, to be clear, it never actually missed an Olympic Games, but it was going to be dropped for 2020, believe it or not. These were going to be the first games that there was no wrestling.
Right.
The International Olympic Committee really wanted to send a message to wrestling that it needed to have kind of clearer rules and more exciting format. And it also needed to include women more. I think they're going to find, particularly with Japan being so strong in women's wrestling, that this is really a popular sport at the Tokyo Games.
Are there lessons here, Rachel, bigger lessons about the ways that women's sports can be expanded?
Yeah, I think one is having role models, you know, although the girls I talked to didn't bring her up specifically. I think the fame of Ronda Rousey and female MMA stars sort of normalized the idea that women and girls could do combat sports and win with aggression and lose with grace and, you know, all these things that boys and men do too. So one is models. The other is just creating an environment where girls feel welcome, you know, making sure that if one girl comes out for the wrestling team, maybe trying to recruit another girl so she's not completely alone, or recruit a female manager just to make her slightly more relaxed and not the only one in the room. You know, little things that the people who are advocating for girls wrestling have found can make a huge difference in a girl sticking around or leaving after a day or two of feeling pretty left out.
Well, Rachel, it was a real eye-opener for a lot of people to read this story, and I encourage people who haven't had a chance to check it out at wsj.com/sports. Rachel, thanks so much for being with us on Only a Game.
My pleasure, Jason. Thanks.
So did you notice that I got in a little shout-out to my, newspaper employer just there? Pretty slick, right? Well, the Only a Game folks on the other side of the glass are glowering at me a little bit, so I'm going to also say that you can find a link to Rachel Bachman's journal story at onlyagame.org. I think the crisis is averted. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. And our executive producer is Karen Gibbon. I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thank you for listening.